I've learned that death is not the end of the new flesh.
Mom of the new flesh. I was hoping you'd be back.
Welcome to the New Flesh Podcast. My name is Brett Arnold at Brett Redacted on Twitter.com. I am here today yet again with Jesse Hassinger at RockMarooned on Twitter.com. Hello, Jesse.
Hello.
We are here today to talk about the 2003 the first Platinum Dunes movie. This is a Platinum Dunes, which means Michael Bay produced horror remake. Remake of Tobe Hooper's classic, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the 2003 film that Jesse has famously seen.
Very famously seen.
Yes, very famously.
It was my first Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Honestly, probably was mine too. I can't imagine that 13-year-old me had seen the original Texas Chainsaw before this. I definitely did probably shortly after this movie came out. But I definitely dragged my dad to see this opening night or weekend, and I very vividly remember. I think he was pretty appalled by the hitchhiking opening sequence. Kind of does it right away. But yeah, the 2003 remake made by music video and commercial director phenom Marcus Nispel, who listeners of the show. For longtime listeners of the show will know that Joe and I made fun of Marcus Nispel for years and years just because he's an easy punching bag. He's a, you know, he directed remakes of like two iconic properties. He did this and he did Friday the 13th, 2009. I think time has been kinder to both of his movies than Joe and I have been, but we'll get into that later. But yeah, Marcus Nispel directed, Michael Bay produced. What's this guy's name? Andrew Form and Brad Fuller are these producers who produce all the Platinum Dunes stuff. The last Texas Chainsaw movie was just about 10 years before, 1994, technically, but you know, that movie also came out a couple years later because it had two theatrical runs, but both of which were basically non-existent. It's kind of a more of a video release thing for that one. But yeah, it's been a long time, almost a decade since the last one. So it's back. We'll talk about it. Before we get into that, there's a few bits and pieces. I'll ask Jesse, what's up? How's it going? Anything to report on your end of the world?
Nothing really. You know, I did finally my big movie news, because I'm not watching that many new movies because there aren't that many new movies, and I wish people would just start putting more of their small movies out.
Yep.
I mean, I get trying to hold out for a theatrical release, but I feel like some of those like indie movies from the summer should just be like
they're gonna get lost if they don't come out. Yeah.
So I did catch up with The Invitation, which I had never seen. I'd been on my, like, oh, I got to see that list for, like, years, and I watched it, and that was a fucking good movie.
Yes, Karen Kusama, probably my favorite Karen Kusama movie. What has she done? Because she did Girl Fight?
She did Girl Fight, which I also had only caught up with recently, which is sort of what inspired me to watch this one. She also did the live-action Aeon Flux. She did Jennifer's Body, which I think is terrific.
Yes, and which she had, like, a critical re-evaluating as of late, that movie.
Yeah. People have kind of caught up with it. And she did Destroyer, which I also think owns. But
it's
I feel like
very good. It's very good, and, like, the big quote-unquote twist is, like, so... It's I don't want to say unnecessary, because I think it works, but it's, like, it's so unsuspected that it's genuinely surprising. Like, it took me aback. Yeah. I was like, oh, I didn't know this movie was working on that level as well.
Yeah, same. So I kind of got into an accidental Karen Kusama marathon, because I had been trying to catch up for movies from the year 2000 that I hadn't seen for an upcoming thing I'm going to be working on about the best movies of 2000. I'd never seen Girl Fight, and it was on, actually, because I had Stars because of this Texas Chainsaw project, I saw they also had Girl Fight, so I threw that on and liked it. And then my wife and I just happened to watch an episode of notoriously Brett-disliked TV series.
I know what you're going to say, The Outsider.
The Outsider, yeah, I don't even remember the name of it.
And, yeah, because it sucks.
Yeah. Well, we haven't finished it yet. We're going through a very at a slow outsider-like pace.
Oh, maybe that'll help. Yeah.
we're still like seven. I think we're seven or eight in. And I noted we completely just watched the next one, and then it was like directed by Karen Kusama. And I was like, all right. So we watched like two in two nights. So I haven't seen The Invitation. Let's make it three in a row and finish up with the Karen Kusama series. So I've been last weekend. I was on a big Karen Kusama kick, and she's great. Yeah, I mean, I liked her a lot from Jennifer's Body and Destroyer. But those all these things really contributed to what a I feel like I'm. You know, several to a decade late being like, what a talented filmmaker.
Well, yeah, she is. And she just got handed the keys to, Dracula, I believe, she's doing now for Universal. So that's very exciting. The Invitation, if you haven't seen it, it's the fucking bomb. I reviewed it back when I was reviewing stuff, I think, for Business Insider. It's such a good, slow burn movie. Another movie that ends on, like, a totally surprising, like, world-building note that you wouldn't see coming. I really love that movie. And just like a masterful, like tense experience. And what's his name? John Carroll Lynch. John Carroll Lynch is so good in it. Yeah, I just call him the Zodiac Killer. I was like straining to think of his name.
Even though you can never know for sure.
Yeah, yes, of course. We'll never know. All right. Quickly, let's go through some news. Archive 81 series in the works at Netflix from producer James Wan. What is this? Archive 81 is a found footage podcast horror drama exploring the supernatural and gentrification in the big city through a found footage format set in the greater New York area. The show's time period alternates between the present day and the mid-90s. The show follows Dan, a solitary archivist who works at a remote facility where he has been tasked with cataloging hundreds of hours of old audio tape. His employer is New York's Housing Historical Society, or so he thinks. Many of the recorded tapes appear to consist of old interviews between a social worker named Melody Pendris and the residents of a mysterious apartment tower block known as the Visser Building. It's not clear what Melody's looking for in her interviews, but the more tenants she talks to, the creepier things get. As Dan probes deeper into the tapes and the mysterious origins of the building, Melody's story starts to reveal unsettling facts about the archive, his employers, and even the nature of the physical world we live in. The podcast is in its third season. New episodes are coming out still. The show, the guys who created the show, the podcast, will serve as co-producers on the upcoming series. James Wan will executive produce. Sounds like it has potential to be cool, but I don't know anything about it. What else do we have here? Oh, this is the biggest news of the week, probably. J.J. Abrams just set three projects at HBO Max, which is HBO's new streaming service. It's so confusing. I'm not going to go through all the different versions of HBO, but HBO Max is the future forward one that has, like, I think the Friends revival is supposed to be on there and a bunch of other crazy shit. But they're producing three things from J.J. Abrams, one of them being Justice League Dark, which was once going to be a movie directed by Guillermo del Toro, but now it's going to be an untitled drama based on characters in the Justice League Dark universe. Which debuted in DC Comics in 2011. It's a team featuring magic-based characters such as Zatanna, Deadman, Swamp Thing, and John Constantine. Over the years, Warner Brothers has attempted to get a big-screen version off the ground. Doug Liman was once attached, as well as Guillermo, as I said. Warner's backstreamer DC Universe also had a short-lived drama called Swamp Thing, which, if you don't know the history of Swamp Thing, Jesse, we talked about it on this podcast in the past, that show was like basically... I forget the specifics of the situation, but it was basically this every episode cost like $10 million or something. Like it had this huge like $200 million budget for this show that ended up dumped on a streaming service that no one has. And the reason it was cost so much is because they were supposed to get some tax credit that the city like ended up reneging on. They didn't get it. So like once that happened, they just shut down production. So like it just the show ended up being 8 episodes instead of 10. And it still costs like... I want to say it cost like $200 million. But that is what Swamp Thing on DC Universe was. And there's also a Constantine TV show on NBC that I know people liked that was folded into the Arrowverse on the CW. That is something I know nothing about. But this Justice League Dark thing sounds like it's basically just Justice League, but with like darker magic themed characters. Go ahead.
I have a demand that I would like to issue to this series, not knowing whether she's actually in the comics of Justice League Dark. I officially demand that Cara Delevingne, character Enchantress from Suicide Squad, be included as played by Cara Delevingne, preferably.
Yes.
Love Enchantress. I think there should be more Enchantress out there in the world. Seems like she would be a good fit.
You know what? That blew my mind that she was in that movie because I couldn't remember. I mean, I don't remember anything about that movie other than it plays like a jukebox, just like playing pop music while you're introduced to these characters because it was re-edited by a trailer company. But yeah, Cara Delevingne, there's a bunch of people who get like a really bad rap in that movie, just like no time to do anything. And she's definitely one of them. But that's not even the most exciting J.J. Abrams project. Overlook, a spin-off of sorts based on the iconic hotel featured in Stephen King's The Shining, is being produced by J.J. Abrams' Bad Robot as well. It will explore the untold, terrifying stories of the most famous haunted hotel in American fiction. It'll reunite Bad Robot with Stephen King and Warner Brothers because they just did Castle Rock, which I couldn't finish season one of, but I hear season two is good and it's standalone, so I might check it out. The 10-episode drama is being written and executive produced by Dustin Thomason and Scott Brown, who previously worked on Castle Rock. The series has opened a mini writer's room to get a jump on scripts during the industry-wide production shutdown. I just want to say that this is not the same project as the Overlook Hotel, which was supposed to happen in 2014. If you remember this, it was announced that Mark Romanek was directing, and it was being written at the time by Glenn Mazzara, the Walking Dead showrunner. And this is just like a little bit about that script. The film was supposed to tell the origin story of the Overlook Hotel through the eyes of its first owner, Bob T. Watson, a robber baron at the turn of the 20th century. Watson scaled the remote peaks of the Colorado Rockies to build the grandest resort in America and a place he and his family would also call home. So this is what he's talked about. Last week he talked to Collider about it. He said, it's a great script, I think. It was based on a prologue to the novel that Stephen King wrote, and then that prologue was cut for length. So it's based on Stephen King. It's not just something somebody made up. It's more of an origin story, almost like a Western or a wilderness story, going back to the construction and the desecration of the Indian burial grounds and the construction of the Overlook Hotel and its meaning to its opening night. The problem is it's really expensive. It kind of reads like The Revenant or Heaven's Gate or something, and I think they wanted to try Dr. Sleep to see if, my impression is they wanted to see if there was some sort of Shining universe that would have financial life through them or artistic life for the audience. And I think Dr. Sleep did just sort of okay, and given that our script is so costly, it's a little dead in the water right now. But you know, it's a weird business. It's a very good script. I'm proud of the script. I was stupidly undaunted by its relationship to The Shining because it takes place decades and decades before, but there's very little specific visual crossover. It was just, I thought, a really great story based on a Stephen King thing. So apparently this Overlook is not that. That sounds interesting to me, and I'm sure they're probably working on working from the same material, but who knows? It's funny to me that they're still going forward with it, considering Dr. Sleep just like came and went with like no fanfare. I think horror fans appreciated it, and like I see a lot of horror people talking about it now, especially with the director's cut coming out or having come out on Blu-ray. But it definitely did not make any money, and it cost a lot of money. And it's surprising that they're still going to the well again. But it seems like it's a different, totally different project. So maybe that'll have life on HBO Max. Who knows? More things that have moved. Spiral, the Chris Rock Saw movie, is now opening on Halloween weekend. Oh, wow. A horror movie on Halloween weekend. Who would have thunk it?
Wow.
Yeah.
The old classic Saw weekend.
Yes. Universal went and dated Halloween Kills, I believe, that weekend as well. So we'll see what happens.
It's not a week or two before. I feel like I thought it was like a week or two before.
Yeah, you're probably right. This article's stupid. I don't believe it.
But they're still, that's still very close. They don't usually stack horror movies that close together.
Everyone's going to be fucked up by the schedule. And every movie's going to open on top of another. And I don't know what they're going to do about it. So we will report back on that. The Lodge, the movie that we talked about in the past, is coming to Hulu on May 5th. So fire up the New Flesh podcast on The Lodge on May 5th after you watch that shitty movie. I'm just kidding. It's not that bad. It's definitely worth watching on Hulu. And there's two things I want to mention. What We Do in the Shadows season 2 just started. I am so excited. I either have watched the two episodes that have aired so far, and they're great. This show is awesome. Definitely check it out. And there was a clip from the Sam Raimi produced and maybe even directed Quibi show, 50 States of Fright. It's this it's basically like a Creepshow horror anthology, but it's very, I don't know how to describe it. It's like very silly. The clip that went viral is called The Golden Arm. It's about a woman with a golden arm. It's based on some like old folktale. It looks terrible, but it's on Quibi, and I just want to mention Quibi because it will be lost to time soon. Quibi was a
date this episode. People will be like, oh, that was during the 3 months of Quibi.
Yeah,
not Quibi, the pandemic.
Correct. Quibi. The Quibi will last way shorter than the pandemic. The pandemic will outlast Quibi. Quibi was a service launched by what, Jeffrey Katzenberg, the like DreamWorks guy. It was a service launched by that dude. The whole idea is it's mobile first programming, so like they're vertical videos mostly for your phone, but like also if you hold it vertically and you hold it horizontally, you get different angles and different videos. It's like a very phone first thing. It's something that like when the iPhone first came out, people were probably trying to do, and then they stopped because it was stupid, and then this guy thought he was being a genius and brought it back. But it has launched, and it already, I think in week two, dropped to like 60 places on the iTunes charts or whatever, so like no one's even downloading it. I downloaded it, I watched things for maybe 5 minutes total, and I gave up. It's everything is vapid and terrible. There's probably some good stuff mixed in there because I'm sure they gave good creators some money, but it's mostly like, you know, the whole name is Quibi for quick bites, and they want little short 3 minute things, and nothing's longer than like I think 8 minutes, and I don't know. I'm rewatching 30 Rock because my girlfriend's never seen it. And there's a joke in season one that Will Arnett basically makes Quibi. And it's just funny that they were so ahead of it. It's like truly like eight. It's like even predated Vine. It's basically like 8 second videos. And it's just funny that like, honestly, everything that was a 30 Rock punchline 10 years ago is like now coming to be a real thing. So that's where we are. And with that, let's move on to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Jesse, you've seen this movie before. What was that experience like? Why did you see it? When did you see it? I'm sure you remember because you're like me,
yeah,
and you have movie memories.
I do. I have horrible freakish recall. I wish I could remember even more detail, but I can tell you that I saw it probably the first weekend it came out. It came out in the fall of 2003. At the time, I was dating my now wife, Marissa.
Oh, wow.
We'd been dating for a few years, and she was like one of the first people who wanted to see horror movies with me. My friends growing up were not that into horror movies, and there also weren't that many coming out when I was growing up in the 90s. When I was first starting to go to a lot of movies, they're just like before Scream, there was really not a lot of stuff like that. You know, lots of like thrillers about like rapists and killers. The
right.
Cops are
a lot of serial
like,
killer oh, stuff.
Yeah. Seven or whatever, Copycat, whatever, but not like, you know, kind of hardcore horror stuff. So I rented a lot of horror videos by myself. And then, there was a big, you know, kind of horror explosion in the late 90s and early 2000s. And Marissa was pretty into scary movies. So we would just go to all of them. We would just see whatever scary movies. So that's really why I watched Texas Chainsaw Massacre in a movie theater. I had never seen the original. I sort of knew its reputation a little bit. I don't think I realized how much of a classic it was considered. I feel like I thought of Night of the Living Dead as being the real, like, you know, kind of arty critic's favorite movie.
Yeah, horror film.
Texas Chainsaw was a little more of a kind of, I mean, probably as when I was younger, it kind of felt like a joke because that like crazy title, and you know, I feel like I remember seeing jokes on the TV series The Critic where it was like, you know, Rocky 6, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 5, and like it's Rocky boxing the Leatherface. That's probably my like impression of Hachimachi. Love The Critic, great show.
Yeah, it's so good.
So we went to go see it. Probably we have a couple friends who liked horror movies, and I think I went to, she was living in Westchester at the time and I was living in Brooklyn. So I think I went up to Westchester that weekend because we would sort of alternate where we would hang out. So I think I saw it in like a suburban movie theater multiplex with some other horror minded folks. And you know, I was excited for it because it sounded like extreme and crazy and violent in a way that a lot of mainstream horror movies were not. I don't really remember that much of the experience of watching it except for a sort of deflating feeling where first I think I was kind of into the style of it and sort of the elaborately gunky production design. But I think as it went on, it kind of felt like, okay, there isn't much to this, you know, and sort of ended up feeling like, that wasn't so great. To the point where I've still never seen the prequel that came out a few years later. Which is surprising because I was still go. We were still going to see the shitty horror movies.
Yeah, and I'm surprised, especially because that prequel had a pretty surprising critic take. Like, I'm pretty sure people didn't hate it as much as you'd think they would have.
Yeah, for whatever reason, it just it just slipped by us in a way that somehow the American remake of Pulse or
God, that movie blows.
It does. And there was another. What's the other one where Stay Alive, the video game.
Yeah, the video game one with Frankie Muniz.
Yeah, I definitely saw that, but somehow there must have been something else coming out the same weekend as Texas Chainsaw Massacre at the beginning that distracted me from seeing it, because normally I would just see whatever. If something was a horror movie playing on more than 50 screens, I would probably try to see it. But that one passed me by. And it's not that I hated the Nispel one so much, but it definitely left a kind of I kind of get what this is kind of feeling. And there was
The same day as Saw 3. That may have been
I'm sure I also saw. That's probably, that's probably what I saw instead was Saw 3.
And then you just never went back and saw the Texas Chainsaw 2.
Suffer Life.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Okay. Saw 3, one of my favorites of the series.
God, I'm trying to remember. Two is the Shawnee Smith in the pile of needles one.
Yes.
Three is Donnie Wahlberg.
I feel like Donnie Wahlberg might be in 2 and 3.
Yeah, but I feel like he becomes the focal point of 3. I don't really remember. I remember of the maybe that'll be the franchise we do next on this show because all I remember is I famously on this show, I always say Saw 6 is good, but I don't have any backup information on why I think that. I just remember. I remember thinking Saw 6 was for some reason when that one came out, everyone, including me, was all they finally reinvented the formula. They made it I'm pretty sure it was I don't know if it was I want to say allegorical, but it had a message to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was
a political edge to it.
It had a very political edge to it. And we'll talk about that when we get there. But you saw Texas Chainsaw in theaters in Westchester, 2003. I saw it in theaters in Skokie, Illinois, with my father. I would have been recently 13.
Oh, wow.
Recently 12 or something. Yeah, I'm a child. I was even more of a child then. But I honestly didn't remember much except for the hitchhiker thing. I vividly remembered the hitchhiker scene just because it's so shocking, or it was so shocking at the time. And I still, I do love that shot that goes through her bullet hole head.
That is exactly the when I think of this movie, that's the shot I think of.
Yeah. And that, Nispel understands that and believes that, too. He said that on the commentary documentary. He was when we were shooting this scene, it became clear that we were going to get this shot, and it was kind of a test of the whole thing. If we don't get this shot, the movie's going to suck and whatever. But they eventually got it. They took so many fucking takes to get it. But they got it. And so that my experience is, I remember liking it. You remember not, you said you didn't like it. You thought it,
I was just sort of mixed on it.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty different, I would say. Indifferent is pretty good. I mean, the movie is just my problem with this movie, I guess, is that they all, especially when you watch the document, there's a feature-length documentary about the making of this one, and there's three commentaries in the Blu-ray. I got through two of them, and I watched the whole documentary, and they're all talking about how they shot it in Austin again, and they did it, in the summer in Austin. It was just as hot as it was when they did the other one. It was still, the conditions were terrible. And they really tried to emulate that raw feeling. And they keep talking about how they are trying to make it so raw. And I appreciate that. And I think it does have that element to it in a way. But there's something to that sepia tone and just the way it's cut and put together and the way it looks and putting Jessica Biel in it. It's just it is inherently such a commercial mainstream remake of a classic, even though everyone involved says it isn't and tries really hard to act like it's this raw, visceral thing. And I think
it's slick.
It's slick.
Whatever they say about it, it's slick.
And that's the problem with it, because then none of them think it's slick. They all, or at least when they talk about it, they're all talking about it as if it isn't. And the whole vision that everyone agreed is that it has to be, it has to be this gritty, grimy thing that's scary and isn't about these, like, hot teenagers at all. Like, it's really just about the terror and the dread. And, like, I think this movie's not wholly unsuccessful in a lot of things, but if it's, I mean, they also talk about a lot, Michael Bay mentions it, Nispel mentions it, they're all like, you know, it's a fool's errand to remake such a classic. Like, whoever does it, no matter what director, they're going to get shit on for it. Like, it's ridiculous to even try. And yet, here we are. They made the movie. And, like, it comes with that baggage inherently. And it's, I don't know. It's hard, especially once you've seen the original so many times and you've seen the second one and you know. It's just, it can't help but be a little underwhelming. Even if it is exciting to see, like, Leatherface is scary again, since the last time we saw him, he was screaming. And, no, that's it. He was just screaming. He was screaming a lot. So where to begin? The movie opens with the, like, narration, like it always does, and it's John Larroquette again. They got John Larroquette to do the narration.
They got Larroquette. They somehow got through to his agent.
Yeah, he wasn't busy. So they got him, they did the voiceover. I'm trying to remember how this movie opens.
Well, it does, there's a little bit of, like, a little amuse-bouche of a found footage bullshit at the beginning.
Oh, that's right.
And I think that, like, really is indicative of a lot of what doesn't work about the movie. It's this, you know, they kind of narrate what happened with this crime in 1973 and then say that the only record of it was, the best record of it is this footage that they took of the crime scene right after it happened. And then they go into this little bit of, like, black and white footage, but it's like, it's like just so black and white kind of quasi. And this is before it was after Blair Witch, but before found footage really, like, the Paranormal Activity, like, you know, sort of kicked it into its second,
like,
wave
of its own genre. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's done up in this, like, it's black and white, but it's, like, super high contrast black and white, just perfectly scratched. I mean, it's
that's the whole cool thing. Trying to look so raw, they look so commercial, I guess.
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, not that I'm an expert on what reel to reel video, crime scene video from 1973 would look like, but I'm pretty sure it wouldn't. I mean, you know, it's cool looking because I love high contrast black and white, so it's very cool looking footage. But it's like handheld in kind of an ostentatious way. It's black and white in kind of an ostentatious way. The scratches are there in kind of an ostentatious way. It just kind of feels, yeah, I hate to sound like one of those kids on The Simpsons in that episode, but, like, I'll have to quote that and say the whole thing smacks of effort, man. Like, it just feels like, okay, we're trying really hard to make sure this is gritty and immediate, but, like, the effort is visible there.
Totally.
Anyway,
and also,
yeah, then it goes into the actual story.
Yeah, and also, yeah, that footage doesn't really set, it's set up for no real reason. Like, it's just kind of like, here is, is it implying that, oh no, the footage is like the cop going through the house or whatever.
Yeah, but then it comes back at the end for, like, a cheap scare.
It comes back at the end for a cheap scare, but, like, it's just, like, such a strange setup. And on the DVD, yeah, or the Blu-ray, I guess, there are cutting room floor intro and outros that are like a woman being interrogated by the police, and she's like, well, let me tell you my story, and, like, then it cuts to them at the water hole, and, like, they cut that whole thing, and then at the end it comes back, and that's when it's revealed that Leatherface is still alive, because, you know, there's a scene at the end where, spoiler alert, I think she cuts off Leatherface's arm, like,
yes,
first of all, with so little effort, it's so crazy that his arm just, like, falls off.
That arm must have just been hanging, just barely hanging on.
Yeah, it just comes off with, like, a swipe of a knife. But, like, that comes to fruition in this ending, in this alternate ending where it's, like, that's the big reveal. It's like, well, I know that he's still out there because the guy you got has both his arms and he doesn't have one arm. And, like, the big reveal is that he's still out there.
Yeah, well, and they do that with the found footage too, because they show the rest of the found footage at the end to have the, and it's revealed that crime scene thing is so valuable because, not because they caught the guys, but because they didn't catch the guys. They, like, went into the crime scene and a bunch of people got killed, and then the criminals got away.
Yeah, but, like, who got that footage then? Like,
yeah, it was recovered at the scene. Yeah,
yeah.
It's like this weird kind of bookendy thing that just kind of exists too. I mean, there's a few things where you know, it's very poorly done. At the beginning, in this intro sequence, the sheriff or whoever is going through it and being like, oh, there's, what is that? Oh, that's a nail. That's someone's nail, like a fingernail. And yeah. then they like very ostentatiously show when that happens later in the movie, the person's nail breaking on the wall as he's trying to claw to get, which also, like the arm cutting off, happens in a really, like, is a, in a really weirdly
like
easy,
over the top. Like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, a guy grabs the wall and his fingernails snap off.
Yeah, it's, Nispel really, like, he wants to go for the gore, but I just don't think he, like, there's no real world thinking or impact. It's just like, right, let's just right. do it. Give me the nails. Yeah. And it's like, yeah. okay, but it needs more. It's like, no, I don't care. We're doing it. It's funny that you mentioned bookends because I wrote down a quote from Mr. Michael Bay who demanded the bookends. He said, we need bookends because we want people to believe it. So the whole idea behind setting it in 73 and to have apparently the bookends help feed this fervor that it's real. They just want it. Everyone talked about this 100 times on the thing is how a huge part of it is that when they did research, Michael Bay figured out that like 8 in 10 people believe that this like Texas Chainsaw Massacre is based on like a thing that happened. Like a specific event. So he's like, well, that's what we have to lean into. We have to, like, if people believe it, let's make them believe it. And, like, let's set it up as if it's super real. But again, they're all talking about it with such care and, like, oh, we want it to be this real thing that people think is, like, a documentary, basically. And if you watch the movie, it's the farthest thing from what that is. It's just, like, the most polished, like, it's, sure, it's, like, you made it sepia-toned, but, like, I don't know.
Well, and I think also, not to like backseat filmmaker here, because I'm sure this could have been just as bad, but it is the kind of thing where the logical extension of what Texas Chainsaw, the original, is like, the logical extension of that it probably is found footage. And it's so wild to me. I mean, this is before Paranormal Activity, like we said, and a lot of other things, but it's still wild to me that this movie could come after Blair Witch and they'd be like, yeah, we're doing something similar here in terms of making it seem real. Like, Blair Witch does really seem very real if you're watching it and don't know that it's made up. This movie does not do that.
It looks like it's made by a guy who's directed 200 plus music videos, which he has.
Right. So yeah, I could see how maybe this approach would have made sense in a kind of post-found footage world 10 years later, but or 8 years later, whatever. But as it is in 2003, yeah, it's a 2003 aesthetic with bookends that say, oh, but no, this is like Blair Witch dudes, and it's really not.
Yeah, it's definitely a strange choice that I don't think really pays off in any real way. So we cut to... Then we cut to, after that opening scene with the, you know, the police footage, the kids on the water in Hull, and then they're driving in the van, this time their mission, the other one, they were driving to, like, the grandpa's house or whatever, and they, like, stumbled across wherever they were. This one has a bit, is a different setup. They're basically on their way to a Lynyrd Skynyrd concert in Dallas, I believe, after having traveled to Mexico to buy a fuck ton of weed. There's like 2 pounds of weed in the car, is revealed at some point. But yeah, they're driving through Texas, and this movie doesn't really waste any time. Like they pick up the hitchhiker pretty quickly, who incoherently speaks about like a scary bad guy who's gonna kill them all, and then she pulls a gun out of her fucking crotch and shoots herself in the face, through the mouth. Which I will say, this is, let's talk about, like, how it deviates from the original immediately, because I think they all the people involved all talk on the commentary about how it's important to them that they didn't just remake the 1973 movie. They said if it was the same characters, the same family, and even if they just had cast, like, real actors in this movie, because this movie at the time, like, besides Beale, they're all pretty much nobodies. Eric Balfour was, like, on 6 Feet Under. That was really his only big credit. They just said they wanted it to be its own thing really badly. They wanted their own characters. They wanted to make this movie its own and not have people know what to expect or have characters already in mind. So right away, they change all the characters, and the hitchhiker, notably, is not like part of the Sawyer family this time. First of all, the Sawyer family is now the Hewitts for some reason. They're just the Hewitt family again, just because they want to make it their own and different. So the hitchhiker here is like, you can tell it's like a victim. It's clearly like a girl who was captured by the family and wandered away and is now on the street. It's kind of like where Sally ends up at the end of the first movie, and maybe where Jessica Biel will end up at the end of this movie. So I kind of think it's clever. It's a clever way to subvert what people are expecting right away.
Yeah, and what it sets up, I think, is one of the good ideas they have, which is it sets up a really weird dilemma where, okay, someone has just killed themselves in their car, so they want to report it, but they have drugs in the car, and they don't want to get, obviously, they don't really play this angle super hard, but you don't want to get blamed for the person who killed themselves in the car. They could probably dump the body and get away with it, but that they don't want to do that because they seem like they're
Half of them want to. I think it's important that Jessica Biel's character, for some reason, the movie thinks it's important, I guess. They like kind of shoulder the responsibility on to her. They kind of make it seem like, half the people all were voting for, like, let's get the fuck out of here. But Jessica Biel, I think the other girl too, maybe Pepper or whatever her name is, I think maybe they also, she was also like, yeah, let's not do that. But it's mostly like Jessica Biel is the one who's like, come on, guys, let's be good about this.
Yeah, yeah. And that horrible trauma they experience of seeing someone shoot themselves in the head and then being stuck with this person's body and having the responsibility there is really interesting and can really turn the screws. And they do a little bit with that. Can I talk about like who that, what the deal, like just a detail with the girl very from the end of the movie that we find out?
Go ahead.
The thing that I think makes that conceit work less and almost less as the movie goes on is that you find out, I think I'm were to understand that they took that woman's, I don't know why you really would be able to intuit this, but Jessica Biel does and we're meant to also, that the family took that woman's baby and like kind of kidnapped it. But she got away, I assume was going to be killed, but got away. And now she's like wandering this road. And I don't want to get too nitpicky about like, oh, well, would a person really do this? Because, you know, it's, who knows how different people react to different situations. And I don't want to get super like self-righteous as a parent, but that's it. As a parent, it's hard for me to understand how the psychology works for, they took my baby, so I'm so traumatized that I'm going to wander the back roads, seemingly not very far from where she started out. So it's not like she's been was stuck in the woods and wandering for days. And then when someone tries to help, I'm going to shoot myself with the gun I have on me. And just like, that is so contrived and so contrary. It just seems like a bunch of, I mean, I have no idea how old the spell was because he was making movies for a long time. Not to say that everyone making this movie was like a 23-year-old, but it's a decision that seems born out of people who none of them must have kids.
Because... Yeah, I think that's a plot line that was mostly exciting. Like, I feel like you caught it, but I feel like most people probably wouldn't catch that like weird. I guess they do make a point of it, but I can speak to that actually, because on the commentary, one of them, the writer is on it, the guy who wrote the screenplay that ended up being, you know, cut a bunch by the time they made the movie. And one of his through lines was that that totally got cut, was that Leatherface, it was implied in his version that Leatherface, that is what he was. Leatherface was a baby that was left by a family that was a victim. And Leatherface in this version isn't a part of the family. He's an adopted son kind of that they're raising, but he doesn't really know that. So like the writer had that backstory written in at some point and it definitely got cut. So
there's hints of that, like that you can kind of expect, okay, well, if they're, you know, that's if they're taking a baby, what do they want the baby for? To like be part of this horrible family? And you know, you can sort of connect those dots, but it doesn't really come
through. They definitely cut it out, like in terms of like overt mentions of all that stuff, but it's definitely there if you look for it. Also, the cannibalism angle is like there if you look for it, but also not really there at all on the surface. Like they're not eating these people. I mean, like there's like meat hanging in their slaughterhouse and whatnot. But they're not ever seen eating. The dinner table scene, they said they actually were going to film it. They had a whole dinner table scene, but it didn't fit the tone of the movie they were going for. Because like that scene is in every other movie, and it is kind of always like a comic scene. Even if it is dark, it's always like super fucked up and weird. It just didn't fit the tone of this super dark version of this movie, which I totally get them cutting the dinner scene out. But the whole stuff with Leatherface being a son or being a victim, that like that whole backstory is interesting, I guess, but it's just the movie doesn't get into it at all. I'm trying to think of something else the writer said that was cut. you can keep talking if you have anything, or else I'll just cut out this silence.
Well, yeah, I think that it sort of speaks to what they're trying to do with this movie, which is try to make something that like has a little more, not more grit than the original, but like returns to that kind of sense of like, this is something really, you know, unthinkably messed up and really horrifying on a human level. And then that's true that like having your child taken from you and being abducted by crazy murderous family who wants to take your child for their own, that there is something really scary about that and really visceral about that. And I think that it's not really leaned into hard in the movie. And I assume they're trying not to make the kind of a horribly exploitative version of that where it's like all about a child in danger. So I appreciate that.
Do you want to hear the original script?
Oh, they were trying to make it much more about child endangerment, I assume.
The original script, Erin, Jessica Biel's character, is 9 months pregnant.
Oh.
So the original ending, he talks about it. This is actually the only, there's a commentary that's like the cast, but it also has the writer on it. It's the only one with the writer on it. And like the cast interviews is the same shit they included in the documentary. But whenever the writer speaks, I was taking notes because he says crazy shit. And he said the original ending had Erin, who's Jessica Biel, 9 months pregnant the whole movie. She was chased around. She winds up in a slaughterhouse where she finds shelter. And it's just near dawn. And she goes into labor. And she winds up delivering the kid. And just at the brink of dawn, as Leatherface is prowling around, the baby starts crying, giving her away. And the slaughterhouse door slides open and he walks towards the camera with the chainsaw. And the movie fucking ends.
Jesus.
Yeah. So,
I mean, that would be definitely at least like...
Would be talking about it more, you know what I mean?
Yeah. That's, I mean, that sounds horrible in a kind of different way, but at least kind of commits to its horribleness. The way it's handled in this, it's sort of this carrot that's sort of dangled, and all that's kind of left after you chop out some of the more, you know, crazy elements is just a bunch of behavior that to me never really scans as like all that believable with what they give us. Not that someone couldn't be so traumatized that they would leave their child or kill themselves or whatever. But the way that what the movie gives us to me is like just not
totally
enough.
I think it's funny that you brought it up before I did, because I was like, I have all these alternate facts, but you brought up like the thing that remained in the movie while they cut all that shit out, because it's still there. But like, it was, can you imagine a version that was as overt as the one I just read? Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's probably more in the spirit of the original couple of movies, but I can see why they would say, okay, that's too much.
This writer also had such a backstory for Leatherface. He said, I already told you he isn't flesh and blood. He was a child. He was abducted. But he also, like, there's a scene that Nis Bell fought for, the scene where you see his face and it's like his nose is gone. And in the script, there was all this stuff about he was forever picked on because his face was being eaten away by tumors and cancer when he was a kid, and that's why kids made fun of him. So there was all this stuff about that in there that they cut out that kind of, I guess, makes you sympathize with him. I don't know what the idea is with that, other than like to give him a backstory that is kind of harrowing. Uh-huh. There's another idea that didn't survive, is that when he was a kid, his father locked him in a horse trailer for 3 years because he knew he was bad. And then like, I believe the character that was I mentioned the deleted alternate opening and closing. I think that was supposed to be his mother, because in this version, when he was a kid, his father locked him in the horse trailer and his mom like let it happen and like is regretful about it. So she's talking about it now. And like, that explains why Leatherface is so fucked up. So they basically, my point is this movie, where it falls apart for me, in terms of especially, like, in terms of being a remake of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, a classic movie, is they took such a simple premise, which was, like, kids stumble upon, you know, hippies versus, small town versus, like, rural, urban America, whatever you want to say it is, the silent majority stuff. Like, just the premise is a bunch of kids get killed when they go where they shouldn't go. And this movie just piles on, like, so many story elements that it's hard to keep track. And like, including, there was even a deleted scene on the DVD where Jessica Biel tells Kemper that she's pregnant. So like, even though the 9 months pregnant thing was cut, they even at the last minute, her character was supposed to be pregnant the whole time. And like, there's that whole through line with the Kemper being revealed that he had an engagement ring to give her, that gives the movie this like emotional arc, which I don't hate that. I kind of like the, oh, this is sad. Like, we get a reason to care about Kemper, even though we died like 20 minutes into this movie.
Yeah.
And by the way, the first time Leatherface wears a person's face, it's Eric Balfour's face, and it's genuinely very scary, I think.
Like, that's a great moment in this movie. And she sees him, his face, and recognizes her boyfriend's face on him, because she doesn't know at that point what has happened to him. That's like a really good, smart,
the way his eyes like look through the mask, it's just so scary looking.
Yeah. Yeah.
We talked about this last time where, like, I mentioned, like, the behind-the-scenes footage of the last one was so good, but, like, the movie itself looks so bad. That's how I feel about Leatherface in this movie, because the behind-the-scenes footage of Leatherface is all so gross and scary, and, like, he's just, like, really intimidating. And, like, I guess you get a little of that in the movie, but I think Nispel just likes cutting too much that you don't really get the scariness that was totally there. And, like, that is just, like, bad directing, and I hate that, like, that got in the way of a pretty good concept. I think Leatherface, the concept of the mask here is really cool. I don't know if it actually shows on screen, but in one of the documentaries, they showed that, like, the guy who created the mask, like, he was basically doing it as Leatherface put this together himself, and it's very crudely done, and there's, like, a woman's mouth just on his neck. Like, there's just, like, really creepy details that I'm pretty sure just you don't see on screen. And I think it's crazy that it's a through line through these movies where, like, behind-the-scenes footage has, like, crazier, grosser stuff than the actual movie. And for a movie called The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it's just, like, unforgivable to me. There's also the scene where Morgan is hung and, like, the chainsaw goes up his crotch through the top of his body, you know? Like, down the middle. And, like, that scene, which I would say famously now exists in a movie called Terrifier and a movie called Bone Tomahawk. There's a really gnarly someone getting cut in half. This movie would have beat him to it, but it got cut out. It is completely cut. On the DVD, there's a lot of footage of they just basically shot, like, they basically had a bucket of, like, blood and guts above it, and then, like, just poured out, and then Nispel just kept saying, "More blood!" So, like, there was just so much blood pouring out of this guy. That whole thing is cut. But besides that, there's a few, that's like really the only moment of gore I can think of that was cut. There's no like unrated version of this movie because they just cut all the deleted scenes out and they're just on there as deleted scenes. No one like recut them back in. But yeah, the movie I got sidetracked, but the movie was basically, so yeah, they have the body in their car and that's kind of the driving force of the plot now. Is what do they do with this? And like, that's why they end up waiting around for a sheriff to show up. And the sheriff ends up being kind of like the dad character in the old one. This movie, I think the writer said it, the director said it, they all said it. Without Arlie Emery, this role probably would have been really corny and stupid. But Arlie Emery, classic actor from Full Metal Jacket, most famously, probably. Also Saving Silverman.
He's also the head of the army man in Toy Story.
That's right. R. Lee just like apparently every scene is basically him improvising. Like they basically threw the whole role away and just let him do what he wanted. The whole thing about like when they're rewrapping the girl's corpse with like saran wrap, that whole thing, and he's like talking about how like, oh, she's wet down there. What'd you guys do with her? Like that was all just him being creepy and improvising. And they all were like just so impressed and like how funny he was off camera, but like once he turned it on, he just was nuts and all that stuff is improvised. Almost all of his gross lines are improvised. That role, I mean, it's pretty clear he's bad from the get-go. Not really.
Yeah, that is at least like a little more in the tradition, I think, of the earlier movies in that, well, I think one of the fun things, as I said, or I think on an earlier episode, is like getting the different variations on the family and the kind of different creepy characters of who are associated with them. And this one is mostly throws its lot in with like kind of generic weirdo-looking guys and girls. You know, it's not like, there's not like a lot of memorable creepiness the way the guy with the metal plate is memorable, or even the way that Matthew McConaughey with his stupid robot leg is memorable. But Ermy is one of the few things that really pops. I think there's kind of like a bit much of that stuff for my case. And again, it's like sort of begs belief about like how these kids are just like, okay, this guy must be on the level. He's sounds insane and disgusting and corrupt, but like, I guess I gotta listen to him. But at least that's like, that's an interesting like dynamic to throw in there. And he's memorable in a way that the other family members and such, I could not tell you anything about them really, except like maybe a vague description of what they look like. But he's sort of the best one in the tradition of the non-Leatherface side characters who are really creepy or weird or kind of in on this whole, you know, disgusting conspiracy, whatever. So like that, I appreciate that. That's like an element where this movie pops in a way that it feels like it's in the tradition of the originals, but not, you know, not beholden to them.
Totally. So basically the rest of the movie, we at some point meet this kid named Jebediah, who's got like just hilarious teeth. That's kind of his only prop, is like, he's really dirty. And they gave him like bat teeth. I don't know how to describe it. It was like a little bat boy. They meet Jebediah, and he's just a little creepy kid. And then eventually, I don't know, they end up at the house. They basically start getting disposed of one by one. Then, I think half of them are in, or it's like Aaron, Andy, and Kemper at the house, and the rest of them are back at the van, and the sheriff's at the van with Morgan and the other girl, Pepper. And then Aaron comes back there, and they're all getting fucked by the cop. One really gross detail, like when the cop makes him sit in the back seat and like recreate the shooting of the girl just to fuck with them. Jonathan Tucker, who I think is a good actor and has been in a lot of good stuff. He was in The Deep End at the time, around then, and something else. I like him in the Bruce Willis movie Hostage. I like that movie. Kevin Pollak's in it.
yeah. There's he's actually a buddy of mine, like from high school, went to camp with him. So I feel like I've always been updated very readily about like what Jonathan Tucker is up to. He's like, my man Tucker's in that movie. You got to see it.
Oh yeah, he's
a good character.
He's a great character actor. He is so method. Apparently, they showed the footage on the documentary. It doesn't make it in the movie. Every single time he put the gun in his mouth, he made himself throw up on purpose for the scene. And no one wanted him to, and like, and Arlie Ermey thought it was fucking disgusting, and like, he kept like getting mad at him, and like, every take, they said 7 or 8 takes, he threw up every time, and then they ended up cutting it out of the movie because no one wanted to see that. But every time, because Jonathan Tucker was like, if someone did that, you'd probably gag and throw up, right? And he's like, yeah, I guess so. So he said he ate a bunch of granola bars before the take, and then would just throw up. It's fucking disgusting.
That's dedication. I always love the. When no one asked him to, which is the implication in behind, I feel like most method acting is finally spoken aloud when someone says, but literally nobody asked him.
Nobody said do that. And yeah, he did it. But yeah, that scene's really fucked up. And then he also takes, the sheriff takes him in the back of his squad car because he like threatens him with a gun or whatever. That's not loaded. It ends up being not loaded, but he handcuffs him and drives him back to the house. And he's like just torturing him in the back seat, like breaks a bottle on his face. Like it's super fucked up. And then Morgan gets hung up and cut in half. Aaron ends up in the basement, right? Where she finds her friend Andy. Oh yeah. She ends up killing her friend. This movie really piles on the like Jessica Biel is responsible thing. Like she's constantly, the movie's always like, yeah, if it wasn't for her saying let's do this, they'd probably be out of there by now. And then she has to kill her friend. It really piles on her, just her character. I don't really know why.
That's true. I didn't really think about that, but that is true. It does kind of feel like kind of this kind of sadistic, no good deed goes unpunished kind of sensibility that while the camera is also, we should note, ogling her relentlessly.
Oh, yes. Oh, by the way, this movie, a movie has never looked less like it was shot in the 70s than this movie. I said this in a text. I'm definitely stealing this bit from somebody. Somebody said it about a different person in a different movie, but I'll say it here. Jessica Biel just looks like she knows what a cell phone is, and you can't shoot around that. And she looks like you can't put a 2003 girl like that and call it 1973.
It's funny. I mean, nobody knew this at the time, but like Jessica Biel's movie career, I, you know, was looking it up. I mean, she's done stuff. Certainly she did stuff before and after. She's on Seventh Heaven, blah, blah, blah. But like, and again, they can't control for this when you're casting, but it is funny that they go out of their way to set this movie in 73 and they get Jessica Biel, who, no shade on Jessica Biel. She's perfectly good in this movie, but yeah, her career is such a monument to the 2000s in particular. Like, when was Jessica Biel starring in movies? Basically 2003 to 2008.
Like,
not before or after. Certainly
the mid-aughts were her time.
Yeah.
So yeah, this movie definitely, I think it's more important as like to look at it. This movie definitely inspired like the next decade of horror movies. I feel
it was a big hit. It was a big hit at the time.
Huge hit. It costs like under $10 million, which at the time was like this was Michael Bay, who's known for, you know, huge budgets exclusively. Like, his whole thing is like, I make expensive movies. So his whole thing was like, I'm going to get with these two producer bros of mine from friends of mine from college. We're going to make this this production company called Platinum Dunes. And the whole thing is we're going to make really smaller budget stuff with like we're going to pull directors from commercials and music videos and make them. We're going to find the next. God, I'm trying to remember the comparison they made. They made a crazy comparison that like Michael Bay is this to this person's this. And it was really insulting. And I really want to find it. It was something like John Cassavetes or something. I don't know. It was a really... Oh, no. He compared what Michael Bay is doing for Marcus Nispel to what Jerry Bruckheimer did for Michael Bay. And I was like, okay. Sure. That definitely worked out for Marcus. Anyway, so Platinum Dunes is like... It just became like the way horror movies were made for a while. Like, 2003 is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It costs $9.5 million. Makes 107 worldwide. Then the 2005, they remade Amityville Horror. The budget was double that, so it was like 19, but it made 108 million. Tried and true formula. 2006, they did the Texas Chainsaw sequel. Excuse me, the prequel, Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Beginning. That one cost 16 and it grossed like 50. So like dwindling returns here. But then they had something called The Unborn, which was a really bad David S. Goyer movie. 2009.
Oh, I think it was Odette Justman.
Yes, that's right. Who was supposed to be the It girl, who was not the It girl. Friday the 13th, Marcus Nispel's back, baby. That one made $91 million also, and it cost 19. And then they remade Nightmare on Elm Street in 2010, cost 35, made 115. So they make these movies for relatively low cost, and they all make money. It's kind of a formula that gets redone by Jason Blum. And they do it on an even smaller scale, and they're more successful.
You think that Bay and Blumhouse also will now do some remakes? So do you feel like Bay is somewhere going like, God damn it, that was my idea?
Oh, for sure. Bay's definitely salty at them, I'm sure. The only thing that they have still, I think, they're doing The Purge. They still have The Purge. That's Platinum Dunes. Those movies are really cheap. I guess each one costs a little more, but the first one costs like $3 million. Platinum Dunes also did, for some reason, those Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movies.
Yes.
the guy who directed that, the first one of those, also did Texas Chainsaw 2. Oh.
Right. He's one of Bay's guys. Yeah, how come they didn't throw Nispel Ninja Turtles, huh?
That's a good question. We have to get him on the pod and ask him. But yeah, Platinum Dunes, basically, they're still churning out stuff. They did Ouija and Ouija 2. A Quiet Place is them, and that movie's huge. That made $340 million worldwide. They still have The Purge coming out, and they still have A Quiet Place. But they're definitely slowing down where like Blumhouse is picking up. But it's clear that Texas Chainsaw was such a hit that it inspired the next however many years. And we got so many remakes. We got a lot of movies that look like this, like sepia toned, like I don't know what to call it other than sepia toned. It's just like very
it's very like elaborately. I mean, and this is also totally what I'm talking about with like the kind of heavy effort production design cinematography. It's so interesting to me that this was shot by the guy who shot the first movie.
Yes, and it's weird that it wasn't because the studio was like, we have to get this guy back. It's because Marcus Nispel actually used him as his DP for videos.
Independently. Exactly. That's such a weird. But it's also interesting because it's not, you know, like I said, it's a slickly shot movie. It's not like incompetently made, although I think you're right that it does cut around too much sometimes for stuff to be really scary. It sort of hustles along a little too much. But there are some scary moments, and it's certainly a good looking movie. But yeah, it has this sort of art directed feel of like, let's make sure we're, you know, and Bay does this too, this sort of like making sure the sweat on the brows is very vividly, you know, illustrated. Yeah. And it just has a kind of, I mean, at its best, that can feel kind of like, you know, painterly and kind of, you know, it's certainly a distinct look and it's very uniform across the movie. But it does have this kind of weird thing where it's like, this isn't like what movies in the 70s look like. This isn't what the 70s presumably actually looked like. So it's this kind of weird music video interpretation of vaguely old-timey, but, like, you know, still like current enough to be, like, kind of rock and roll. hence they're like going to see Lynyrd Skynyrd. It's like very, I kind of get the impression not a whole lot of thought was put into that besides, oh yeah, some guys from Lynyrd Skynyrd died, right? So like that's like funny and ironic or like chilling or whatever. Like it just kind of feels like, you know, it's very surfacey. Like it's a very strong surface sheen, but it doesn't really have much texture to it, even though it's they're laboring to try to get texture out of all the like goop and muck and kind of, you know, teeth put in and like,
there's a live possum.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like the first movie does such a better job of making that stuff feel sort of found and sort of uncanny. And this movie, it just feels like they've stumbled into like a kind of, you know, museum of ghoulish horrors that's very vivid and very like expensively rendered. This is before like CG blood became so popular. So it doesn't, this stuff looks legitimately wet. It's not like, it doesn't have that kind of like fake splatter to it. So it's, you know, it's sort of interesting to watch it because it's very watchable. I watched it again without feeling like I was in too much pain from it. But the visual aesthetic of it is kind of, it just feels kind of mannered in a way. Like it's people who are viewing this stuff entirely through a lens of like what other movies and videos look like.
Yeah, that's very well put. I'm trying to, before I talk more about it at large, I'm trying to just get through the plot. What do you take of when she gets to the trailer? She like runs away and she gets to a trailer and there's all these other people there. You want to talk about these people?
Yeah, I mean, that's the, you know, some of that feels pretty cheap to me too, because it's like, it really kind of feels like the big creepy thing about like the kind of mom or grandma figure is like, oh, she has like kind of a, you know, she has kind of a neck, like a thick, like a kind of a fat neck or whatever. And it's like, all right, so that's what's really creepy about this movie is like, this lady's fat, like,
yeah, she got a fat neck.
Yeah, like, ooh, you know, it's just kind of like, look at these hillbillies kind of stuff. And there's some stuff that's kind of creepy about it. You see them, one of them sort of caring for the baby. And that's when you're supposed to kind of make that connection, I guess, that the woman that we saw earlier lost her child to them. But yeah, you know, it just doesn't really pop like the stuff in the relationships aren't that clear, but not in a scary, ambiguous way. It's just sort of, you know, her, like, there's some kind of not so great filmmaking where they like, give Jessica Biel, you know, goes in there to hide, and then she doesn't realize at first that they're in with Leatherface,
as every character in this franchise is when you meet them.
Yeah. And they give her tea, which I don't even think, I was like confused during that scene because you're like, obviously the tea's gonna be drugged, but then I'm sure there's a shot where she drinks it, but I didn't really catch that, so it just kind of feels perfunctory. Like, you don't see her hesitation or her trust in drinking it. Yeah. They just kind of assume that she drank it.
Yeah.
And then she kind of falls down and gets knocked out.
The spell doesn't have time for fucking drinking tea shots.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's a perfect way of putting it, because like, it's not really much of a scene, that scene, is it? Like, it's,
no.
There's nothing that burns about it or really develops. It's just sort of like a thing that happens pretty quickly to get these characters on the board. They don't really do anything. And it gives you some information quickly and sort of overly quickly, and then it's kind of on to the next thing. It's not, you know, it doesn't have any real scare to it.
Yeah, and it ends with her, as I said, cutting his arm off, like, very easily. then she flags down a trucker, and...
Oh, there's a pretty... That chase through the slaughterhouse, I think, is actually kind
of
cool.
It's she has to hide in all these corpses of stuff. That was funny. They said they actually rented that meat from a real slaughterhouse and didn't buy it. And the Department of Health said if they put the meat in bags of plastic, they would allow them to rent it instead of buy it. So it saved them a bunch of money. And if you notice, yeah, every piece of meat is in a big thing of plastic because it was going to be eaten by somebody later.
So someone unknowingly got to eat like some steaks or whatever. There were some Texas Chainsaw Marcus Nispel steaks. Yes, they should have marked that
Jessica Biel was hiding in one of them.
Yeah. Yeah. You could have been like Biel, you know,
Biel meat. Yeah.
Her constantly exposed, cut off midriff may have grazed against this meat, and Marcus Nispel's Steak of the Month Club will send you one every month.
The
Platinum Doom Steak Collection.
The cast and crew. There's like a montage of them making fun of Nispel's voice, where they're all just like they're all just barking orders in German because like they're all making fun of him on set. Basically, they all said that like if the crew hated him because, like, he just never wants to stop. He's like a 24/7 guy. Like, they basically had to force him to follow the schedule. He just wanted to keep shooting all the time. Just like, what a maniac. This fun facts. This movie was produced by someone named Mike Fleiss, who you may know as the creator of The Bachelor and The Bachelorette. And Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire, which is his first reality TV show.
So he has experience in meat markets already, is what you're saying.
Yes.
And rim shot.
the explanation for it is just, Nispel just said, yeah, he just loved the franchise so much that he spent years trying to get the rights, and he eventually got them. So when Michael Bay and New Line were going out for it, they had to talk to this guy about it, and he was totally on board. So he's a producer of these very successful movies. Very, very strange detail. I'm trying to think of what else is funny about the backstory here. Michael Bay was never going to direct it. There was always rumors that he was going to, but he says he was never gonna. This is really cool. Before the movie was even sold, Michael Bay made a trailer for it, a teaser that you can watch on the DVD that's not anywhere else. It's just all black. The screen is black. It's all audio. You hear a woman's footsteps and surround sound. Someone's chasing her. You hear them get closer. It's really intense. There's 4 seconds of silence. And then there's a chainsaw rev. Everyone jumps. He said they show it to people and everyone would always jump. And every audience would lose it. And they sold the movie based solely on this trailer that was all black screen. And then just cut to the title, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And oddly enough, the MPAA wouldn't let them use that as a trailer. Even though it doesn't have any footage, they thought it was too much anyway.
Wow.
It's super strange. Again, the MPAA hates this franchise, if you paid attention.
I do remember the trailer for this used the famous, you know, photograph noises. Ba-ching! It was a good trailer. It was like a very slick and scary trailer.
I can confirm what that is. They mentioned what that noise is. Are you ready?
Yeah.
It's a tuning peg on a piano string.
Huh.
Yeah, very fascinating stuff there.
Now you can make your own Texas Chainsaw trailer.
Yeah. It's necessary. Apparently, the reason they hired Marcus is because they were really just looking at commercial directors, and CAA suggested him, and Michael Bay had knew him, so he thought it was a good fit. They loved his reel. He directed videos by Puff Daddy, Tony Bennett, Aretha Franklin. It's everybody. He basically said he was reluctant to make a movie because you make so much more money doing what he does, and like you have so much more control, and like he just didn't want to cede control like that, but he had to take this opportunity. He basically said it'd be blasphemous to make this movie, but Daniel Pearl said he wanted to bookend his career by making chainsaw movies, so please direct it, because they were friends. So Nispel said he would do it. Marcus's wife is a huge Six Feet Under fan, and that's why they cast Eric Balfour. Or they had him in, and he read, and he was really good. Blah, 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 blah. We mentioned they changed the dynamic of everything. The only character from the original that's the same is Leatherface. They, like, make a big point about that. They, like, they really made it their own, and, like, you can say, I don't know, I feel like there's two sides of the coin to remake. Some people say that they should be faithful, and some people who say they should be not faithful, and, like, to me, I think a remake... should be of a movie that wasn't that good, that could be good if you get another shot. And that is too often, that is almost never the case. It almost always is, this movie's a classic, so let's try again. And that isn't what works, I don't think. But if you're gonna,
there's some examples where there's kind of fun. I mean, I don't think any of these movies are great, actually. But A Star Is Born is like one where, you know, there's a bunch of different versions, and it becomes kind of fun over the years to say, okay, let's see the 70s one, which is legit bad. Let's see the 50s one, which is quite good. Let's see the 2018 one, which is sort of interesting. So I think that can, but those stories are also so well worn that it's, you know, that Star Is Born is like in the DNA of so many movies already. Texas Chainsaw probably is too, but it's a very specific, even the title, it's a very specific thing to try to say, okay, we're going to do our own Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Totally.
It should be like at least the Louisiana one, the Louisiana Chainsaw Massacre or something.
For sure. The only there's another fun fact. So you noticed, you texted me this, and I also texted my friend it like 10 minutes before you texted me. It was very strange. But you texted me that, oh, Harry Knowles' head is in this movie.
Oh, Jesus Christ, yeah. And I this is the horrible research I did.
Yeah.
For this, is I looked up the Ain't It Cool News review that Harry Knowles wrote of this movie that he was in.
Did he love it? He loved it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he liked it. He was, I mean, whatever. Who gives a shit about what Harry Knowles thinks of anything, really? But, like,
describe Harry Knowles for the listeners that may not know. I mean, yeah. I know me and
oh,
you.
Oh, what a blessing. What a blessing to not know.
Please.
Harry Knowles, I mean, I'm sure you did too. I followed his
Oh, in high school, Ain't It Cool News was my homepage, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Ain't It Cool News is this website. It still exists in a weird way. Where that was one of the first big, you know, movie news.
A shell of its former self, certainly.
Yeah, it did scoops, you know, they would review test screenings and review screenplays, this kind of stuff that's sort of unauthorized or extremely unauthorized.
Yeah, it was always like... The whole thing was, it was always like reviewing stuff before it came out. It was like pre-production. It was like spy stuff, I feel like.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, some like writers of some repute, I guess, came from there. I'm no one that I'm really ride or die for in terms of their writing. But Harry himself is sort of known as a literate man-child, or I should say sub-literate man-child. You know, his reviews are
I've heard stories. The man wears a diaper around Austin, and like I've heard a story of him leaving his shitty diaper in an Alamo draft house on the floor. So
yeah,
I had heard
about that. And yet, well, and he'd been accused, I mean, he sort of stepped back supposedly from his website after there were a lot of sexual harassment.
Oh, that's right, I forgot about all that too.
Dozens of so he seems like kind of a creep. And but he was, you know, very into the Austin film scene.
Hugely.
And,
yeah.
And so he was, you know, I think he's also has a cameo in The Faculty because he buddies does. With Robert Rodriguez. And in this one, his distinctly, you know, fairly large head is like a cameo as a, you know.
Just
as
a head on a platter, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, you know, I don't know, it's weird. I don't know how someone who doesn't know Harry Knowles, but they probably wouldn't notice it. Although it is weird because most of the rest of this is not like preserved body parts. You know, it's like stuff that's rotting or tenderized.
Yeah, it's definitely out of place. And the go ahead.
Yeah, it kind of speaks to the weird kind of in-jokey arrogance that involves to be like, well, people got to recognize who this dope is. So we got to like,
two guys on a podcast in 20 years are going to mention this.
So. And here we are, we've played into it.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, you know, it's I get it, he was in the Austin film scene. I get some filmmaker would be like, oh, it'd be kind of cool because he's a big figure in Austin now to have him play a corpse or whatever, but then to have his head be like, you know, so recognizable. And for, you know, obviously 98% of the audience isn't going to care about that, but it makes it a hilarious time capsule now of a time when, I mean, even 2003, you kind of feel like Ain't It Cool was past its, you know, relevance, but it is bizarre to watch a movie now and be like, oh yeah, there's that dude from that website. Like,
yeah. Well, it's funnier than that because the story is he showed up on set as like, you know, Harry Knowles sleuth, like there to like get scoops. I imagine he's got like, you know, a hat with a pen in it. But he showed up on set and he said, and it was a problem because they didn't want the Leatherface face to leak. They didn't want anything to leak at all. So The way Nispel put it is he did a fake accent being Harry. And he was like, Harry comes up to me and he goes, I love that you, this is like him being arrogant and bragging that he knows about the movie. He's like, I love that you guys are doing it in the 70s. Do I have to... Can I get a script from you, or do I have to find it on my own? And like he went and asked Nispel about it, and they all refused to give him anything. But my favorite, he also came back and said, "Oh, I saw the dailies; they look great." And he was like, "What the fuck?" So to placate him, they put him in the movie. They said they just because he was walking around set, they said to incapacitate him for the day. They just had him like stand under that table and be a head on a platter for a while. And, like, they put him in the movie. But, like, the way Nispel puts it, he said they were behind schedule 2 days because of Harry's visit. Because they couldn't shoot this Leatherface scene he wanted to shoot. They couldn't do this. They, like, Harry Knowles visiting the set disrupted the movie, is my point. And I love that.
It's funny that there's, like, a mix of babysitting and bribery involved with having to manage your Ain't It Cool News set visit exclusive.
Yeah,
whatever,
so fucking silly. I'm trying to look, alternate and deleted scenes. There's not that much. There's that opening alternate closing. That doesn't really add anything. Deleted scene where Jessica Biel says she's pregnant, and that kind of helps explain why Eric Balfour like sides with her over his friends when they're like, you know, let's help out, let's stay with this corpse, do all these things, all that stuff. They have an alternate take of the suicide where you see more of her like body or her like head and parts of her brain fall out of her skull. That was some good stuff. There's not a lot of other stuff. The commentaries and documentaries are so much. It's all kind of redundant. They kept talking about how they wanted to make Leatherface like the shark in Jaws, and the more you see, the less scary it is. But then also he said that having the mask off was a very important moment for him, so I don't really know if that jives with that. I don't know. I think this movie... Oh, wait, the product placement thing. He wanted to put, like, you know, era-appropriate products there, like a Tab can and stuff, but they wouldn't know. He said they asked Tab. They wanted Tab. They wanted Vaseline. They wanted Vicks VapoRub. They wanted a Hulk t-shirt on the kid. They were turned down for everything except for Coca-Cola and Mad Magazine.
And, I took note of the Mad Magazine there. I did love seeing that, I gotta say.
Yeah, it worked. The Mad Magazine said okay. But he said the most memorable phone call he had was to Vicks VapoRub. And they were like, well, what's the context of you using Vicks VapoRub? And he goes, well, it's about a murderer. He takes a guy's face off and he's prepping the face by rubbing the Vicks VapoRub into the bloody mask. And he said the Vicks guy just laughed and was like, no, no way. So that's a fun detail. And that it wasn't urgent for them to make any sort of domestic deal for distribution, but it ended up being New Line and after all, because the movie secured foreign investors based on that teaser. The movie basically was in the black before it even was made. It already had the money made. Just that that teaser is really worth seeking out. It's pretty cool. Just a black screen with, like, you know, it's like an audio trailer. Overall, they made it their own. They didn't remake it shot for shot. Good for them, but it's just okay. I think this movie probably... I think the last 1, 2, 3 of these have been like 2.5 stars at best.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I would agree. This one is like... It's a little more... You know, it's definitely less shoddy than 3 or 4 in terms of just like... You know, even with this stuff like her having an easy time chopping off Leatherface's arm. Also, I mean, I feel like... This is extremely cheesy, but like it was hard for me not to think of like, oh yeah, if they're chopping off his arm, they gotta like he's got to have like a chainsaw arm like Ash and Evil Dead 2, right? That's what you're gonna do with the. But then that was not to come to pass because there was no sequel to this one, only a prequel. But yeah, it's a little more professional than the last couple of them, but there's really no. It suffers like those. There's like no strong subtext here. It's just
the first one has all that baked in, and this one just doesn't.
Yeah, and you get the feeling that the filmmakers are pretty uninterested in that aspect of it. Like, they really want the feel of it, but they don't really want the like. You know, they don't maybe don't completely understand that to get the feel of it. You would need something a little more going under the surface than just like kids get scared, kids run from guy, most kids get killed. There's like, you know, kind of a doominess to it that's okay, but it's not really atmospheric, you know. I mean, of course it's like full of, you know, set design atmosphere, but it doesn't have that kind of like bone deep atmosphere that really the first one does. Totally.
And it's annoying because they shot on location. The only set is the trailer, and yet the whole thing still has that tobacco sheen of just like looking like it's trying to be grittier than it really is. And
yeah,
it was a fool's errand. Everyone said it on set, even like it's a fool's errand to remake that movie, but they did it anyway. And you know what, like as far as remaking a movie goes, I've seen worse. And
oh, certainly.
Yeah. Yeah, like I don't know, we'll talk about worse ones, I'm sure, in the future. The next one is 3 years later, I believe. It's called Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Beginning. It stars Jordana Brewster.
Ooh.
I believe
the Toretto herself.
Yes, the Toretto is in the building. Originally, the film had the subtitle The Origin, but it changed to The Beginning. Don't know why. And yeah, we'll talk about that movie next week. Thank you, Jesse, for being here.
Of course.
Anything to plug? I don't think anyone has anything to plug anymore.
I got nothing. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, subscribe on Patreon, and give us, you know what, give us 5 stars on iTunes. I haven't begged for reviews in a while. Give us 5 stars. Say you like the Texas Chainsaw series. We're having a good time.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. See you next week.
See you later.
Along with the new flesh.
I've learned that death is not the end of the new flesh.
Along with the new flesh.
I was hoping you'd be back.